Well, good evening. I encourage you to turn in your Bibles, or as might be the case this evening, in your digital device to the Gospel of John, chapter 10. John chapter 10. I invite you to turn there, and while you make your way to that text, let me thank you so much for your presence tonight. Hope that you've had a good afternoon. If you came to the gathering this afternoon, I know you are well fed. Hopefully you've already had your nap in this afternoon and you won't take it during this particular hour of time. We'll do all that we can to ensure that that is not the case this evening. I'll yell in strategic locations in the lesson to help with that. As we talked about this morning, when it comes to ideas and opinions in regard to Jesus' identity, there were a lot of different ones in his day, and there continue to be a lot of different ones in our day as well. But there were, as we are focusing on in this series of studies, occasions when Jesus himself spoke in very clear terms regarding his own identity. In fact, in John's Gospel, 7 times, Jesus does that by coupling a declaration, a clear declaration of deity, with an important and an expressive metaphor. When Jesus said, I am, as we talked about this morning, I am Jesus of Nazareth, before Abraham was, I am this morning, his humanity and his deity. When the Jews heard that statement fall from the lips of Jesus, there was no doubt in their mind what he was claiming by that very simple statement. Their minds would immediately go back to Exodus chapter 3 and verse 14, Moses at the burning bush, where God identifies himself to Moses as the I am that I am, Yahweh, the self-existent, eternal God. Though Jesus would have spoken originally in Aramaic, John translates what Jesus says into Greek. And in the Greek language with which John writes his gospel, he doesn't just say the common I am, but the way that he phrases it in the Greek is I am, I am. In other words, there is a particular emphasis on it. It's the same wording that we find in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. And that was the version that many Jews in the first century read from. It is the version that many of the apostles, when they quote Scripture, are quoting from that particular version of God's Word. And so there would be an immediate connection in the mind of any Jew who heard that statement fall from Jesus' lips to the claim that he was making. These were not accidental designations on the part of Jesus. These were strategically proclaimed at certain periods of time as he made an unmistakable claim to be more than just a man. And so in John chapter 6, for example, in the context of the Passover feast, Jesus there declares himself to be the bread of life. In John chapter 8, the context changes. No longer is it the Passover, but now it is the Feast of Tabernacles. And one of the prominent elements of the Feast of Tabernacles was the lighting of 4 75-foot-tall candelabras that would illuminate the city of Jerusalem and would bring to mind to the Jews of that day the pillar of fire that had led their ancestors through the wilderness. And it's in that context that Jesus declares, I am the light of the world. And then in John 10, on the heels of his restoring sight to a man who had been born blind, thus bringing light to this man who had known only darkness, Jesus employs a metaphor that is found throughout the Old Testament writings, and it is an image that was very commonly used in first century Israel, and that is the imagery of a shepherd and his sheep. Now, in the first 10 verses of John chapter 10, what Jesus does in that section is he draws a very distinct difference between himself and the religious leaders, that where he is someone who promotes peace and security, the religious leaders, on the other hand, promote hostility and insecurity. Where Jesus is trustworthy and compassionate, the shepherds of Israel are dishonest and they are unloving. And it is there in verse 7 that Jesus declares himself to be the actual door of the sheep, that he is the exclusive way into the fold. And the implication, of course, is that if you do not go through him, then you remain on the outside of the fold, and therefore you are not among the saved. The fourth metaphor in John's gospel comes in the same context as I am the door of the sheep, or the door of the fold, and it is either during tabernacles or shortly thereafter tabernacles. And you'll notice in chapter 10 and verse 21 that in the minds of his audience, there is still this very clear remembrance of what had happened back in chapter 9, and that is Jesus healing the man who had been born blind. And it's here that Jesus again uses this familiar imagery of shepherds and sheep. And before we read the text itself, I want us to think for just a few moments about sheep before we actually get to the shepherd. Remember that Israel was, for the most part, not just an agrarian culture, but they were a pastoral culture as well. And what I mean by that is they didn't just grow stuff. They also were heavily involved in livestock. There were sheep and cattle that would be grazed on different areas of land that wasn't productive for growing crops. And therefore, everyone in Jesus' original audience would have been very familiar with the characteristics of sheep and the dangers that affected them. And there's not a lot complimentary about sheep. Now, I didn't grow up on a farm, so I don't know a lot about what I know about sheep I've read, but sheep tend to be rather dirty. They're not like those, you know, nice, clean, white Serta sheep that you see on the mattress commercials. They stay out in the pasture all the time, and they can't clean themselves, and so they have to depend on a shepherd to keep them clean and free of parasites. Sheep are easily frightened and confused, and even to the point that they will run off cliffs and plunge to their deaths. And so they need a shepherd who will guide them and provide them with direction. Sheep are pretty much defenseless. You're never going to hear of a high school team, college team, or professional team ever be referred to as the fighting sheep. Sheep don't strike fear into anything or anyone. They have to depend upon the shepherd to protect them from wild animals and from the evil intention of thieves. And sheep aren't very bright. And because of that, they are often wayward. You don't see a trained sheep in a circus act. You can't teach a sheep to shake, to beg, to roll over, to play dead. And because they're not the brightest of animals, even though they don't go looking for trouble, they just sort of are predisposed to finding it. And because of those characteristics, there was incredible value in a dedicated, skillful shepherd. And again, the comparison is not a flattering one, but it's an accurate one, isn't it? Because we are very prone ourselves to making foolish decisions as we look for the greener grass on the other side of the fence. And we do it completely unaware of the dangers that are lurking there. And the list of those who sought greener grass is long, isn't it? In Scripture, it starts all the way back at the very beginning with Eve, who the greener grass in her mind was the desire to know good and evil. For King Saul, the greener grass was, he thought, and found in power and authority. For David, the greener grass was thought to be the embrace of Bathsheba. For Judas, the greener grass was 30 pieces of silver. For Demas, it was the allurements of the world. But the beauty of being a sheep is that we have the opportunity to enjoy a unique relationship with someone who is the shepherd of our souls. That we can have someone who can guide us and cleanse us and protect us and bring us in from our wandering into the safety of the fold. And Jesus is that shepherd. Let's start our reading. We're going to look at verses 11 through 21 tonight. So let's start our reading there. John chapter 10, beginning in verse 11. Jesus says, "I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He who is a hired hand and not a shepherd, who is not the owner of the sheep, sees the wolf coming and he leaves the sheep and flees. And the wolf snatches them and scatters them. He flees because he is a hired hand and is not concerned about the sheep. I am the good shepherd, and I know my own, and my own know me, even as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. I have other sheep which are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will hear my voice, and they will become one flock with one shepherd. For this reason, the Father loves me, because I lay down my life so that I may take it again. No one has taken it away from me, but I lay it down on my own initiative. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again. This commandment I received from my Father. A division occurred again among the Jews because of these words. Many of them were saying, "He has a demon and is insane. Why do you listen to him?" Others were saying, "These are not the sayings of one demon possessed. A demon cannot open the eyes of the blind, can he?" Three components to this passage. The first one is that we see sacrifice rooted in the context of deep affection. I think some of us, I certainly leaned that way for a long time, we see shepherds as being rather docile fellows. The guys who, you know, are maybe a bit sentimental, you know, they spend their days hanging out with cuddly little lambs. But the truth is that shepherds in the first century world were involved in a very difficult, a very demanding, and even a very dangerous work. They were never off duty. The sheep were prone to wander, and therefore they were constantly under need of the attention of the shepherd. There were the perils that were involved in protecting the animals, not only from predators like wolves, but from thieves and robbers who would attempt to steal them. And so the essential qualities of a shepherd instantly would require things like constant vigilance and fearless courage and an extreme patience. And you'll notice there in verse 11 that Jesus does not simply refer to himself as the shepherd, the exclusive shepherd, but the good shepherd, the noble shepherd, the worthy shepherd, the beautiful shepherd. The word here actually is, we get our word calligraphy, beautiful writing comes from it. He is the beautiful shepherd. And he goes on in verses 11 through 13 to set himself in stark contrast with those who are merely the hired hands. And by the way, in verse 11, in the original, there are a couple of things that are emphasized, both the pronoun as well as the adjective. Literally it reads, I am the shepherd, the good shepherd. And he describes how this sacrifice that he will make is grounded on the deep affection that exists between Jesus and the sheep. And that affection stands in stark contrast to the hired hand who at the very first sign of danger looks to run for cover. Because the hired hand loves his wages, not the sheep. And therefore, at the first moment of conflict, the first sign of any kind of a threat, it's above his pay grade. And so without hesitation, he heads for the hills. He takes off. Where the mention of thieves and robbers back in verse 8 and in verse 10 was a reference to those who were obviously wicked individuals, here the hired hand is simply someone who is committed to his own well-being as opposed to the well-being of the flock. That so long as taking care of the flock is not too demanding or too difficult or too dangerous, he's more than willing to complete his job and to receive his pay. But immediately when there is danger on the horizon, he quits and he leaves the sheep to fend for themselves. But that shouldn't come as any surprise to us. Jesus tells us that. He's only the hired hand. He's not the shepherd. The sheep don't belong to him. They're not his friends. They're not his companions. There's no personal relationship between the hired hand and the sheep. There's no commitment that the hired hand has made to them. And so it's very natural that as a result, he's not willing to step in the face of danger, not willing to risk injury of himself when the sheep are attacked. He simply is going to look out for number one. But where the hired hand is concerned about money and the ease of the job and not the welfare of the sheep, in direct contrast to that, is the shepherd, who cares for those who cannot care for themselves, even in the face of danger. He has an investment in the flock, and he remains there to take care of their every need. And if something should threaten the flock, it first threatens the shepherd, because he stands in between the shepherd, or the danger, and the sheep. And what Jesus reveals for us in the first few verses here, verses 11 through 13, is the great love that he has for us. That as the good shepherd, he is willing to lay down his life even when danger approaches. There's nothing that will scare him away. There's nothing that could cause him to stop loving us. You think about that. There is nothing we can do that would stop Jesus from loving us. Now, he may not be pleased with us, but there's nothing we can do that would stop him from loving us. Because he's the good shepherd. He's the beautiful shepherd. But what sets Jesus apart is not just his willingness to protect the flock. It's not just about his willingness to risk his own life or his own welfare. Jesus says here he stands ready to sacrifice himself for the sheep. You'll notice in verse 11, he says there, the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. And the word life there is speaking about more than just his physical existence. It involves his personality. It's sometimes rendered with the word soul. And what it pictures here is the good shepherd who is ready to sacrifice the totality of himself for the sake of the sheep. That when peril comes, Jesus is not going to turn and run away. When adversity strikes, he's not going to shrink from the task that is before him. In fact, just the very opposite of that. His death is not going to be some sort of an accident or a tragedy in that it is taken from him. Instead, he is going to willingly lay down his life for the sheep, compelled by incredible love. Jesus will not run from trouble, he will run towards it. He will voluntarily give himself for us. In fact, that point is made four times in these verses. Verse 11, verse 15, verse 17, and verse 18 all make that point. The one who has no sin, the good shepherd, will give his life to cleanse and to purify the sheep, to provide for us who respond to his call. The second part of the text is found in verses 14 and 15. Here, Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. He repeats the claim, but he shifts now the theme. He shifts from an emphasis on sacrifice to now the emphasis is on mutual knowledge. He says in verse 14, I am the good shepherd, and I know my own, and my own know me, even as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. The point Jesus makes here is that the shepherd knows the flock. That they're not just a bunch of animals to him. That when it came time at the end of the day, he would go through and he would count every head of his sheep. And if one of them happened to be missing, he knew what sheep it was. He would begin a search, and he would do so knowing the characteristics of that particular animal. The word know here, by the way, is a word that speaks of more than just a knowledge of facts. It implies trust and intimacy. It's not just knowing something because you've read it in a book. It's because you know it because you've experienced it. And what Jesus is saying in verse 14 is that our connection between the shepherd and the sheep is not a theological one, though that's true. It's a personal one. Jesus knows you. And Jesus knows me. And though there may be millions of sheep in his flock, he knows each and every one of us individually. Reading through the genealogies is hardly the highlight of anyone's day. The first, you know, if you read through the Bible and you're trying to do that in a year, even preachers give up when they get the First Chronicles. It seems dry and dusty, and you're reading names that you can't pronounce. But I tell you what those genealogies emphasize. They emphasize the fact that our God knows us by name. And if that was our genealogy, I tell you what, we'd read it with a lot closer eye, wouldn't we? David, in Psalm 139, in verses 13 beginning, talks about the fact that he is fearfully and wonderfully made, that God wrought him in the womb of his mother. Jesus talked about the fact that God knows the number of the hairs on our head. And Jesus isn't making the point there that God, our Father, knows, you know, the trivial details of our life. The point that Jesus is making is just how well he knows us. The Good Shepherd, he doesn't just know our name. He knows our backgrounds. He knows our natures. He knows our deepest joys, and he knows our most severe heartaches. He knows our strengths, and he knows our weaknesses. He knows everything about us. Just like a shepherd would know a sheep. Now, that's a humbling thought. But Jesus doesn't stop there. Jesus' desire is for more than just a knowledge that runs one way. Jesus wants this to be a reciprocal relationship. He makes himself known so that they can know him. And I love what one man had to say. He said, "The phrase, 'The Lord is my shepherd,' is written on a lot more tombstones than it is on people's lives." Marvelous point. The Good Shepherd invites us to pursue a personal relationship with him. He's not as a two-a-day athletic coach who's shouting and screaming at us to drive us in the direction that he wants for us to go, but as the Good Shepherd, he seeks to lead us in the path where we should walk. There's a story of a group of tourists that had taken a trip to the Holy Land. And as they were out touring, they came across a flock of sheep that were being driven through this small village. And fascinated with the sight, they got out of the bus and they began taking their cameras and shooting a bunch of pictures. And as they watched the events as they were transpiring, one of the tourists asked the guide, I thought the shepherd was supposed to lead the sheep from in front of them. Why is the shepherd driving them from behind?" And the guide simply responded, "Sir, that's not the shepherd. He's the butcher." Christianity is not a religion about God. It's a relationship with God. And knowing the shepherd and being known by the shepherd is a mutual knowledge that is intended to change us in significant ways. You'll notice in verse 15 that not only does the shepherd know the sheep and the sheep know the shepherd, but Jesus says that this mutual knowledge is analogous to the knowledge of the Father and the Son, that between the Father and the Son there is a union of wills and purpose and works, that there is absolute harmony and oneness. And likewise, the Good Shepherd knows his sheep individually, and he is better aware of their own needs than what they are. And the way to get to know the shepherd better is by listening to his voice, experiencing his daily care, and thus the shepherd, the good shepherd, becomes more deeply known by the sheep. That leads to the third point of the text, and that is that the flock is increased by discerning ears. Notice what he says in verse 16. He says, "I have other sheep which are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will hear my voice, and they will become one flock with one shepherd." The reference here, obviously, is to the Gentiles. Back in chapters 10 and verses 1 through 5, Jesus referenced a fold there, and it seems that in that context, the fold that he has in mind is the nation of Israel, that there are those within the nation of Israel who will hear his voice and recognize the voice of the shepherd and respond to it and allow him to lead them. But in this section, the fold that he's talking about is not the physical nation of Israel, and yet there are people within that other group of sheep who will also respond to his voice. And they will come forth to join the other sheep, and they will become what Jesus describes as one flock with one shepherd. That the God who created all men and loves them equally is about to send forth his offer of salvation through Jesus Christ to all of the people of the earth, that they might know the shepherd and respond to his voice and enjoy his love and his care and his provision and his protection. And that the unity between these two vastly different groups of people is not going to be enforced by them being held together by some sort of artificial or external structure or organization, but instead it will be based on their mutual faith and love as they all hear and respond to the voice of the same shepherd. And here's where it gets difficult, doesn't it? Because we're in this constant battle to listen to the right voice. Our culture shouts lies at us. It looks to sell us counterfeits that offer life, and yet the reality is all it offers is despair and death. You listen to the voice of Hollywood and you will be tempted to feel ugly and overweight and poor. You listen to the doom and gloom of cable news and you will be tempted to fear that the sky is falling. You listen to the voice of our culture and you will live for the fashionable fads that are here today and gone tomorrow instead of the lasting truth of God. You listen to the voice of social media and you'll find yourself languishing in negativity. Friends, our ears determine our shepherd. And we have to train our ears to discern the right voice. To remember that the voice of the good shepherd, his voice is distinct. And his sheep hear his voice and respond. Where are we giving our ear when it comes to painting a perspective of life today, or determining what life is about, or what's happening in our world? Whose voice are we listening to? Are we listening to the voice of Facebook or Fox News? Are we listening to the voice that comes out of Hollywood or Washington, D.C.? Do we realize that the reason we don't hear the voice of the shepherd has nothing to do with the shepherd's failure to speak? It has everything to do with our failure to constantly be listening to his voice. Cultivating a discerning ear means that we will always listen to the voice of Jesus. How is that going to happen? He's not just going to speak audibly to us. The shepherd speaks through a book, doesn't he? A powerful book. And yet a book that many of us fail to give adequate attention to. And thus allow the voice of the shepherd to call out to us. Remember that when we hear well, we'll live well. That where the good shepherd is always speaking truth to lead us into the fertile fields of love and obedience, the enemy is going to use a multitude of avenues that are lies and in his attempt to lead us out into the barren wilderness. Verses 17 and 18, Jesus concludes by taking us behind the self-sacrifice that will produce this new and united flock. He says in verse 17, "For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life so that I may take it again. No one has taken it away from me, but I lay it down on my own initiative. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again. This commandment I have received from my Father." Jesus says that the sacrifice of the Son is directly related to the Father's love for the Son. That the ultimate control of Jesus' sacrificial death does not lie in the hands of Judas or Caiaphas or the Sanhedrin or Pilate. It lies with Jesus himself. That the good shepherd is not helplessly entangled in some mesh of intrigue over which he has no power. He makes the point, no one has the authority to take my life. I will die only if it is permitted. Jesus is not going to lose his life, he's going to give it. He's not going to be killed, he's going to choose to die. He's not going to be a victim of circumstances. He's not going to be like the millions of animals that came before him that were dragged unwillingly and without understanding to the altar. No, 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 no. This is the good shepherd who will die because he chooses to do so. And you'll notice that his vision of sacrifice is not just focused on the cross, but there is glory to follow. He doesn't just have the authority to lay it down, he has the authority to take it up again. He is implying here the victorious emergence from death. And then notice in verse 19, 20, and 21, the Jews that are present, they don't miss the claim that's being made. A division occurred again among the Jews because of these words. Many of them were saying he has a demon and is insane. Why do you listen to him? Others were saying that these are not the sayings of one demon possessed. A demon cannot open the eyes of the blind, can he? We see this struggle within the hearts of people in regard to the conflicting information that they seem to be getting. He speaks like a madman. But madmen can't do what he does. The struggle between his deity and his humanity is what they have problems with. And they ask a question that has forever confronted men, and that is, who is Jesus? Josh McDowell, in his book, More Than a Carpenter, makes a very clear point. He's one of three things. He's a liar, he's a lunatic, or he's Lord. One of those three. He's either a liar, he knows that he is deceiving people, he is intentionally setting out to deceive people, or he is a lunatic. He's saying things, he's not responsible, he's just, you know, he's a crazy man, he's deluded, and he thinks he's God, but he's really not. Or he's Lord. And that's the question that humanity from the days of Jesus have had to answer. Who is he? Do you think he just set out to intentionally lie? That doesn't jive with what we know of Jesus being a man of integrity and honesty. Is he a lunatic? No, he's far from that, isn't he? It only leaves you with one option. He is who he claimed to be. He is the great I am. What I find interesting, just quickly here, this could almost be a sermon in and of itself. Jesus is called a shepherd three times in the New Testament. And on each occasion, there is a different adjective that precedes the word and that sort of grows in stature. And so here, he is referred to as the good shepherd. He speaks of his willingness to sound forth his voice, to lay down his life for the sheep. He is good because of what he is willing to do for those sheep who belong to him. And then over in Hebrews chapter 13, and verse 20 and 21, he's referred to there as the great shepherd. And the emphasis now is shifted from the cross to the resurrection. Jesus doesn't stop being the good shepherd, but now the empty tomb declares him to be the great shepherd. And through the centuries, there have been a lot of good men who have sacrificed themselves for the lives of others, some even in our own day, but only one could give his life and rise again. Clearly, he is able, therefore, to lead his sheep as the great shepherd past death and into eternal life. The third reference is in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 4. And there he is referred to as not the good shepherd, not the great shepherd, but the chief shepherd. And his chief shepherding is going to be ultimately revealed and demonstrated when he returns. When those who have heeded his voice and who have followed his leading at his coming receive the crown of glory that will never fade. Jesus is the good shepherd. And he's a great shepherd. And he's a chief shepherd. There was a little boy who couldn't wait for worship to end because he wanted so badly to share with his parents what he had learned in Bible class that morning. As he climbed into the car, he was elated to tell them that he'd learned a new Bible verse in his class. They were working on the opening phrase of Psalm 23. The phrase, of course, is, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." But as often happens with little kids, he proudly recited it, not as the text is actually written, but as he heard the passage being recited. And so he told his mom and his dad, as he recited the verse, "The Lord is my shepherd, that's all I want." The mom, as she looked back from the front seat, she smiled proudly. She didn't try and correct his paraphrase. Instead, she smiled and she said, "That's perfect, honey. That's exactly right." And as we close tonight, may the Lord be our shepherd. And may that be all we want. Do you know the shepherd this evening? Do you know his goodness? Do you know his greatness? Do you know his power? Have you heard his voice? Have you responded to the voice of the shepherd who calls? And his sheep hear his voice and come. No better time than right now. If you've not obeyed the voice of the shepherd, why not tonight? Why not come to Jesus, respond in obedience to the gospel of Jesus, understanding who he is, what he claimed to be, trusting that with all your heart, and putting your faith in him, and following his guidance and his direction, and his sheep, from now and into eternity. If we can help you become a part of God's flock tonight, won't you come right now? What a good we stand and sing.